Hello, I'm Claudia Winkleman, and welcome to this free download of the Radio 2 Art Show,
which contains adult themes.
Online, on digital, and on 88 to 91 FM, the Radio 2 Art Show with Claudia Winkleman.
Hello, and welcome to the show. Coming up tonight, author Mark Billingham is here with his new book, The Dying Hours. Actor Barry Rutter talks about appearing in Jonathan Miller's play, Rutherford and Sons. Plus, we take a Radio 2 Art Show listener behind the scenes of Glyndebourne and ask, can you learn to love opera? And in just a moment, Daniel Radcliffe joins me to talk about his play. It's part of the Michael Grandage season. Daniel Radcliffe achieved huge, phenomenal success in the Harry Potter movies, of course, but there were those who questioned how he'd fare once the magic of the Hollywood franchise came to an end. Well, a hugely critically acclaimed run, as Alan in the play Equus put an end to the speculation, with critics exclaiming, this guy can actually act brilliantly. Incredibly, that was 5 years ago. Since then, he's gone from strength to strength with huge success on Broadway and in the Hollywood blockbuster The Woman in Black. But tomorrow, Daniel returns to the West End, playing the title role in Martin McDonagh's comic masterpiece, The Cripple of Inishman, at the Noel Coward Theatre. Daniel joins me in the studio now. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for
having
me.
Did I pronounce that everything wrong?
You said Equus right, which is fantastic, because I have had a lot of people say Equus over the years
Equus.
As well. But Cripple of Inishman.
Thank you. As I looked at it, I was like, it can't be Inishman. Inishman.
Inishman, yeah.
I feel bad bringing up the Harry Potter thing, because you
Don't.
Must just be like, oh, enough already.
It's fine. You know, it was funny in your introduction where you said that Equus, like, you know, finally put to bed any conversation.
No,
about whether, when it does it, because it didn't, unfortunately.
But, no, I mean, no, it did.
It did for some people.
Everybody knew you were brilliant in Harry Potter, but,
well,
you know, but everyone's just sort of waiting, going, oh, let's see him act.
Yeah, no, I mean, let's see him outside of Potter and you know, and that was, I think doing Equus was a massive part of that for me, you know, and I've met directors since who have said, you should really know that doing Equus made everyone sit up and go, oh, he actually wants to do something. Yeah. I think it was as much of, you know, I never saw it, so I can't comment on my performance in it, but the... It was as a statement of intent of just what I wanted to do and the fact that I didn't just want to be this one character forever. I think it was very important.
Also, can I just say from a film perspective, Woman in Black was brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much.
Did you love it?
I did. I mean, I was very pleased with the film. I'm my own toughest critic in terms of performance, so I still saw a lot that I had to, you know, move on from. But I really, really liked the film. And I thought James, our director, did a brilliant job of it.
And
it was great
with
that
the
it did
screenplay,
so well.
I
Jane's
just...
screenplay is fantastic. I mean, the screenplay was... When you read a screenplay that has so much stage direction and yet is so compelling, you know it's well written. And, it was great fun. And there is some kind of very sadistic joy you get in filming a scene which you know in, like, a year's time
it's
is going to be
terrify.
Making people scream.
Yeah.
Like, there's something there. You know, James would come up to me with an idea and just say something like, oh, God, that's great. That's going to terrify people.
Yeah. I openly wept at one point. I was literally, I've got to make this stop. It was that scary.
Great.
Yeah.
Good.
Talk to me about this play. Was it a definite yes for you? Did you know about it?
Yeah. I mean, I knew Martin's work, Martin McDonagh, our writer, who I suppose people would know his work most now from things like In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. Yeah. And so, you know, very dark, very, very funny. Also, you know, I think the thing people never or don't give enough credit for, because they always talk about how dark and how funny it is actually how moving it is and how the relationships between characters are always throughout his work so brilliantly drawn. It's basically about a young guy called Billy Claven, who is severely, to use the word that the play uses, crippled. And he's living on this tiny island of Inishman, which is one of the Arran Islands. It's set in 1934, and on the big island, they are filming a film called The Man of Arran, which is a real film that was made in the 30s. So Billy sees this as his opportunity to possibly make something of his life, rather than just being the cripple of Inishman, which is what everyone sort of thinks of him and refers to him as.
I can't bear it. I love
it. So he views that as his opportunity to try and make some of his life. So he tries to get over to the island to try and make it to Hollywood. It's the thrust of the play. But really, it's about this community on this island. I mean, it's cruel. I mean, it is 2.5 hours of people being cruel to my character.
Wow.
But it's really funny. And it's there is this incredible sort of incredibly sweet romantic element to it. And, you know, it really has got everything. It's a great show. And in terms of whether it was an immediate yes, I mean, it was pretty much. I mean, Michael Grandage, who's directing us, who's, you know, fantastic theatre director of, of the West End. And this season that he's done, he approached me, you know, to be a part of the season with Judi Dench and Ben Whishaw and Jude Law and everybody, etc. And so, you know, when he and then he gave me a few plays to read, which is an amazing position to be in.
I'll be honest, Michael, it's a no. You know, I sort of want to go to a theme park.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I remember when everyone was saying to me, God, you were so, you know, you were so brave to do Equus and you were so this and that. And I was thinking, well, actually, not really. Like, I was just sensible. Like, because if you could, there aren't many there aren't many other parts for 17-year-old boys in the theatre.
Yeah.
You know, not ones that good, certainly. So, yeah, so working with Michael Grandage on it, I mean, we're 2 weeks into, well, rehearsal at the moment. We are all going to be wanting an audience very soon because there comes a point, that's the thing, when you're doing a comedy, you run the scenes once in the room and everyone laughs the first time you do them and then you don't get another laugh for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
So you it's that battle of trying to keep the faith that what you're doing is still good. And obviously, like, nobody's playing for laughs. It's a Martin McDonagh play, so it only works if you play the truth of it. But yeah, I mean, it's such good fun and I'm doing an Irish accent and it is a lot of fun to do Martin's writing in an Irish accent, you know, it's fun.
How are you physically going to do it, if that's not a weird question?
No, that's not a weird question at all. I've been working with a woman called Janice Price, who has very, 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 very mild cerebral palsy. You know, if you met her, you honestly probably wouldn't know. But she has been talking to me about a particular... because cerebral palsy, I have learned, is a huge sort of umbrella term for lots of other things.
Yeah.
And so she's been talking to me about a very specific form of cerebral palsy, which I've sort of loosely based my physicality on as Billy. It's never pinned down exactly what Billy is doing in the play or exactly what's happened to Billy or what he was born with. But being that it was something that he's had since birth, cerebral palsy sort of fit for me. So that's sort of what I'm basing it off. Yesterday in rehearsal was the first day that I've gone, oh, ow, actually, I need to stretch. Like,
yes.
Because because one side of my body is kind of completely tense for the whole play and the other is not. It's interesting. And to be honest, I'm only going to really know how I'm affected as we go along. And I've just got to keep an eye on it and make sure I've got, you know, a chiropractor on standby.
We're going to break for some music. Don't be alarmed. When we come back, I'm definitely going to ask you to do your Irish accent.
I'm already thrilled. You're definitely not going to hear it.
Okay, I'm definitely going to really hurt you. How nervous do you get?
Very nervous. I think nerves are a huge part of my process, actually. What nerves are, basically, essentially, is a feeling of, what if I go on stage and everything goes wrong?
Yeah.
And there's something... I don't know, there's something important about that because it makes you work doubly hard to make sure that nothing goes wrong so that even if you go out there and it all still goes wrong, you can say, it's not my fault, I put the work in. You know, I mean, so that's how I approach nerves, and I do think they are very important, and anyone who says they're not nervous is either very stupid or very arrogant.
Or lying,
right?
Wow.
Yeah, because they're scared.
Yeah. Never come up to Daniel and say you're not nervous because he's thinking one of three things.
I am
things.
Making a judgment.
Yeah. He might nod, but inside he thinks you're either arrogant, lying, or very thick.
Yeah, exactly.
Go with that.
And people deal with nerves in different ways, but mine is to just sort of leap about like a mad thing backstage. And that's one of the things of doing stage in my career has generally given me, it has just improved my confidence, you know, in terms of walking on to present an award or to do whatever it is that I have to do in front of a large group of people. Once you've done stuff on stage, particularly if it's, you know, getting naked or doing a song and dance number, then you go, actually, if I screw this up, it's not going to be as bad as if I'd screwed that up, so it's fine.
Yeah. And like, I'll somehow physically survive it.
Yes.
I've just got to, you know, there'll be tomorrow. I've just got to get through this next bit. Is that how you make your choices then? Do you like choosing stuff that's going to make you a bit scared? Because I imagine you get flocks. I imagine owls delivering,
They fly in.
Delivering scripted, where you must go, oh, yeah, I sort of know that character. I might not choose him.
Yeah, if I read something and I just, you know, there has to be something in it that's original to me. there has to be something in it that I feel like I haven't done before. But I think that's, I think I get more attention for picking a sort of range of parts than most actors do, even though most actors do the same thing, I think, because no actor wants to be pinned down, but it's just because I've been associated with one thing for so long. Yeah. I mean, admittedly, the films I've got coming out, like, within the next year and a half or so are very, very different movies, which is great, but I think that's the fun, you know. That's when I look at people whose careers I admire, like, you know, I mean, Gary Oldman is the person that I've worked with who I most admire.
I love him.
If I met him, I would actually
physically lick his forehead.
I'll tell him. Okay. I think just when you look at his body of work, the range and the versatility he shows throughout it is amazing and is what I aspire to. So, yeah, it's a process of just picking parts based on what I think is going to challenge me the most and what also I think will kind of challenge expectations. I don't know.
Yes. Do you also book in... Do you get exhausted? Do you have to book in nice breaks?
I'm really bad at booking in nice breaks, actually. I don't really... I had 4 days off when I went away with a couple of friends to Cornwall.
That is not enough.
Months ago.
I mean, I hate to be your mum, but I want you to sleep.
I was trying to work out with somebody the other day when the last time was that I sort of stopped working for more than 2 weeks, and I really, like, it's beyond living memory. So I can't... But to be honest, I like it that way. I've always had structured time, very structured, since the age of 10. I've always been on a film set. I've always had something to do that day. So you take that away, and I kind of go, what am I doing
now?
You know? So if anything, that's like something I could say was like not a negative effect from Potter, but something that I've had to work on as a consequence, was because I've always just had that structured time, and I need to, you know, work out how to fill it better. So I love working. I love being on set. I love being in rehearsal. I love, you know...
The camaraderie as well. Because also, when you go on stage, I think, I've interviewed lots of people before, they go, it's lovely on a film set, it's amazing, but often you're back in your room and there's hanging around. When you're on stage, you all look at each other. You're never in your room.
I don't hang around in my room very much. I'm just like, can I be on set, please?
Can I just watch? Can I make sandwiches?
Exactly. But I interrupted you.
No, not at all. But just before you go on that stage, you all look at each other and you are in this thing together, and they say, that is something extraordinary.
I think the difference for me is that on stage, I become a lot closer to the actors generally, and on film, I become closer to the crew generally. Because I think, and it's particularly my situation on Potter, was that I was the one that was there every day, along with the crew, so they were the people that I would hang out with most, because they were there all the time. And on a play, you do... You have each other's back. And the point is, you probably throughout the course of a run will prevent each other from embarrassment several times, either through forgetting a line or something. You know, you'll cover for each other several times. And that moment of helping somebody out on stage is a very, like, you do in that moment feel like you owe them a lot. So there is a really, really nice camaraderie on stage. And also you get the whole, you know, there's more of a getting to know you process on stage. Because on film, you just get sort of, most of the time you get lumped together on the first day and you go, oh God, I hope we all like each other.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in my career, I have generally, but in a play, you have 4 or 5 weeks of getting to know you. 4 or 5 weeks of getting to know each other and chat. And so it's a more gradual, much more natural sort of process.
Thank you so much for coming in. Do you want to just say thank you in an Irish accent?
No, I won't. Honestly, because then you know, if I do it wrong this time, then that surfaces forever.
I understand. Daniel,
you'll
thank
pay for
you.
It like everyone else.
Thank you so much for coming in. You are going to be starring in Martin McDonagh's comic masterpiece, The Cripple of Inishmahan.
From June 8th.
From June 8th. Thank you very much. Now, when Rutherford and Son opened at the Royal Court in 1912, it was hailed as a sensation, a devastating attack on the unacceptable face of capitalism that gripped audiences in the West End, on Broadway and across the world. This latest revival began life at the Northern Broadsides Theatre in Halifax before going on tour. Directed by Jonathan Miller, it's just opened in London. Barry Rutter plays the lead, John Rutherford. I'm delighted to welcome Barry to the Radio 2 Watch Show. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, too.
So tell us a little about the play, because I'm afraid I don't know. I mean, I've obviously read in preparation, but I haven't seen it.
It's written in 1912, and it's part of that great school of writing, which included Brighouse with Hobson's Choice, where the young woman's voice is beginning to emerge in society. Now, very interestingly enough, I don't know whether you're going to come on to this, but a fortnight after the reviews opened in 1912 at the Royal Court, one of the reviewers discovered that K.G. Sowerby was a woman. And he went back on his review and virtually said, women have no place in society discussing things like this. I mean, it was outrageous. But the play is part of that young, you know, the 1912 suffragettes, all of that, all the thinking. And I'm delighted to say that it, a lot of the debate about it happened on stage. And in the midst of this patriarchal chap's idea of keeping the family business going, come hell or high water, emerges the young woman's voice. And it's a brilliant play. It's unashamedly naturalistic and realistic.
Yeah.
And no apologies for that, either in the production or the writing. And Jonathan Miller has directed it like that. He's really rather composed it as opposed to directing. You know, he's made the observations.
So used to creating operas, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm very fond of the play. Very fond of the play indeed. Everything that happens, like in all great plays, everything that happens in it, you get sent 7 telegrams. Except when it happens, it surprises you.
Yes, absolutely.
That happens all the time in Shakespeare, that you always get telegrams sent about what's going to happen, and then when it happens, you go,
oh.
And the gasps we've had on tour in this play have been quite touching and remarkable. Audiences talk at point, oh, did he really say that? Oh, he shouldn't have done that. Oh, I did. Oh, you bad. Oh, you. All the way. All the way through.
That's what you want, because it once is, they're hooked, you go...
It's terrific. It wrong-foots you at a lot of points, and a lot of those points, people have been really vocal in their shock.
The reviews have been phenomenal, absolutely amazing. Did you always think, when you chose it and you phoned up Jonathan and said, look, love, you've got to do it, or I'm not sure whether you use those exact words, but stay with me.
You can.
Yeah, thank you. Did you think, we've got a good one here?
I knew we got a good play.
Yeah.
And we did open it. We took the risk of opening in the Viaduct Theatre in Halifax. I say risk because it's an underground cellar. You get to it via a cobbled street, and it can be bloody cold in February in Halifax. We got away with it, and the weather was quite nice, and we heated it up. But there it was traverse, so your audience are on two sides, and so everything about it was much freer as opposed to only facing one way. But the coup happened because the very nature and subject matter of the play, an industrialist, happened in an industrial mill, which used to be the biggest carpet factory in the world when it was Crossley's Carpets. And now under Sir Ernest Hall and Jez Hall, it's become this wonderful, wonderful emporium of arts and craft and business.
Tell us about your role in the play and your partner. What's he like?
He's talked about for 25 minutes before he comes on, and then...
Oh, that's quite nice. You're backstage having a sandwich.
I'm backstage.
Already famous. Yeah, they're talking about me. Yeah.
And then the Great White comes on, you know, like in that movie, Blue Water, White Death, The Search for the Great White. The movie's about 90 minutes, and the Great White comes in about minute 89.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. And then the women go to the wall because they're not part of the conversation. Once he walks in the room, the women go to the wall.
Yeah.
It's quite deliberate. She writes that. It's wonderful writing. And then he has two sons, one of whom is expected to take over the family business. But in the meantime, by luck, has invented a new, cheaper way of making molten glass. And the father wants the recipe because the business is in trouble. But also, the daughter, who he's brought up a different class, is having a relationship with his right-hand man for 25 years, but he's a working man, and the disapproval. And then the woman's voice comes out in that and all through. And he blunders on in this way of losing money until this recipe comes up, sort of rescues him, but he's lost all his children then. And then comes the denouement at the end, which is, if you don't know the play, nobody gets it. Nobody spots it.
That's thrilling for you to do every night.
I've spoken to so many people and said, did you know what was coming? No. And although we'd had permission to do this play for 18 months, 20 months, so no one else can do it until we finished it, there was a contract out on it in New York. So last March, I went to New York, because I've loved the play. I've never seen it. And exactly, I was earwigging during the interval, and people were saying, well, I really love it, but I don't know where it's going.
Yes.
And I thought, yes, great.
This is fantastic.
This is great.
But also, as an actor, and as part of the whole team, that must be thrilling each night to go, this'll stir them. They've got no idea what's coming.
It stuns them. Yeah. If the last 15 weeks on tour is anything to go by, it is utter deathly silence.
Or was
which
it?
Is tangible, which yes, is touchable.
Which is lovely.
Great.
Was it quite... Did you feel the pressure about bringing it to London? Were you ever... Were you flattered, or did you think, do you know what, this is not...
Well, the new St James's Theatre contacted us before we'd finished rehearsals.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, before we'd finished rehearsals. And David Gilmour, who's the artistic guy there, came to see rehearsal. Then he came to see the first night in Halifax. And it was a done deal, and it was a matter of when. And luckily, we finished in York on last Saturday, so we've been able to come straight in for 4 weeks.
It's fantastic.
With no break, which is great.
Tell me about...
The new St James's, it's a 310-seater. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Not only for a play like this, but for companies like mine, who can't get into London if you want to. I mean, I've never been a great capitalphile myself. I mean, you know, I think Halifax and Yorkshire
is
the centre of the universe.
Of
exactly. But sometimes the world and other actors and other families and the business wants to see you down here. And the St James looks to be the perfect venue for us.
Isn't it true that you knew Jonathan Miller a long, long time ago and you contacted him and said, just come and have a look at one of our Shakespeares? And he came down and didn't stop clapping for about 5 months afterwards.
Again, you can say that. It's
Thank
not
you.
Quite like
I
that.
I just would like you to nod at this juncture.
No, I asked him to do the play, and then he agreed when I'd sent him the script because he didn't know the play. And I said, look, we'd like to open it in our mill in Halifax. Now, you're entitled not to like it, both you and Isabella Bywater, the designer, but you've got to see it first. They came up and they fell in love with it.
Yeah.
Then Jonathan came up to see our Love's Labour's Lost last year in the mill, in the setting, in the space, and he just said it's one of the best Shakespearean experiences he's ever had.
How
and he directed a few of them on for the BBC, didn't he?
Yeah. No, he knows it. The idea that he went, that's what I read, that he came and saw Shakespeare in your place. Do you know what you guys are doing next? How far do you plan?
Well, we have to plan, now we have to plan to the end of the funding agreement, like everybody else, which is April 15. And a new one should kick in sometime soon. My colleague Conrad Nelson is doing a Russian comedy, a new version of a Russian comedy in the autumn. That's singing and dancing with an Irish flavour. And in January, I start our acknowledgement of 1914-2014 with a great comedy play, which hopefully is going to tug your heartstrings. We don't go to war, but the effects of the war are on us. And it contains a big rush cart, the Rush Cart Festival, the clogging. A guy goes to Gallipoli, of course, he's called up, comes back with one leg so he can't dance. But it's basically a Romeo and Juliet, two families argument set in Lancashire in 1914, and the big events affect the village.
It's going to be brilliant, as is this. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You said I could talk.
Yeah, well, it's my favourite thing. You can, if you want, just sit and stay. You can see Barry Rutter in Rutherford and Son, directed by Jonathan Miller at the newly opened St James's Theatre in London until the 29th of June. Film critic Zan Brooks joins me next after this brief message. You're listening to Radio 2 Art Show with me, Claudia Winkman. Film critic Zan Brooks joins me. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Are they good? I feel good about these films.
And I think summer has come and the films are turning brighter as a result.
OK, let's begin with Behind the Candelabra. There's a lot of excitement and fuss about this. What's it like?
It's brill. It's
really
good. And we're actually very fortunate here to see it on a big screen because, of course, this is directed by Steven Soderbergh, but it's directed by Steven Soderbergh for HBO.
Yeah.
So it screened on American TV last week, I think. And yet it's getting a big cinema release here, and it was at the Cannes Film Festival last week. The downside, of course, is that that the two stars, Michael Douglas and Matt Damon, are ineligible for Oscars for this film, as is Soderbergh as a director, because it was shot for American TV.
Of course.
That's a shame, because they're both absolutely superb in this. This is the Liberace biopic of sorts, or it's a kind of Liberace romance. It's about Liberace's relationship with Scott Thorson, who was his brocaded chauffeur, who would drive him on stage in a stretch limo and then share his bed at the end of the show. Of course, Liberace always denied this. He was fiercely in the closet.
It sounds wonderful. Should we have a clip? This
Please.
Is Michael Douglas. He has an interesting proposal for Scott, Matt Damon.
I hate my life sometimes. I really do.
No. No, it's true. No matter how many people are around, I'm all by myself. Like, I'm with people, they're not really my family or my friends. You know what that feels like?
Yeah, I do.
Yes. Yes, you do. You've been good for me, Scott.
When?
Now. Just now.
Oh, you mean talking?
Yes,
and,
you know. Listening.
No problem. Sure.
Oh, you're very good listening.
People take.
You know what? I have a great idea. Why don't you come work for me?
As what?
Well, you could be my secretary.
I don't type.
Hell, Scott, I can pay people to type. I need a companion, a bodyguard, someone to keep people off my back, someone I can talk to the way we talk tonight. You be my right-hand man. You can take care of the animals. Please, say yes, Scott.
Ugh, I've always loved Michael Douglas. And when he's good, there's...
When he's good, he's great. But you've never seen him quite as great in this way as he is here. It's a very curious film, this, because for the first half, it's like this absolute black comedy of American grotesques. You've got a great supporting turn from Rob Lowe as this vampiric little cosmetic surgeon. And Liberace, Lee, as he's called in the film, wants to make Scott up to look just like him. So he sends him to Rob Lowe to remodel him in the image of Liberace. And as Matt Damon says, I guess I should be flattered.
Yes.
And it's this horrible comedy of American madness and American celebrity. And there's elements of Michael Jackson in there, yeah. of Baby Jane and of the Emperor Nero as well. Then, incredibly, it actually becomes kind of moving. It becomes, these people become human.
Yeah.
It becomes a love story and a story of human frailty. Very gently done. It doesn't grind its gears, but you suddenly find yourself having laughed at these people or gazed on them in pure horror, actually sympathising with them. And that is testament to Soderbergh's impeccable handling of the material, but it's also testament to the great acting from Douglas and Damon. Now, obviously, Michael Douglas is going to get all the plaudits because his Liberace is a thing of kind of trashy, kitsch wonder.
Yeah.
And yet, there should be some love for Damon as well, who's got a much tougher role as the kind of lunkish ingenue who grows down the course of the film. And this is a brave role for Damon to take as a hetero sex symbol in the prime of life, to play an openly gay character, a vulnerable gay character in a film like this.
And also, he was born.
And, you know, he's a long way from born here.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely brilliant.
OK, so this is definitely the film to see.
Oh, I think so.
Behind the Candelabra, Certificate 15, it's in cinemas now. Let's talk about The Iceman.
The Iceman is a very different beast. This is another true life tale of a very different man called Richard Kuklinski, who was a mob hitman, a notorious mob hitman in the 1970s, who was a devoted family man in the suburbs of New Jersey. But you know, in his day job, he was responsible for over 100 kills. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of ruthlessly efficient in his way. He is played here by the great actor Michael Shannon.
Who I adore.
He is brilliant. And if there's anybody who could play this kind of role, it's Michael Shannon, who is, you know, 6'4", this absolute kind of
mountain
of menace.
Yeah.
And he gives a volcanic performance in the lead role here.
Brilliant. Here's a clip. Fired by Roy Demio, Kuklinski approaches Mr. Freezy, played by Chris Evans, a fellow hitman who poses as an ice cream man by day and uses the freezers in his truck to store the bodies of his victims.
Well, here's my situation. I'm currently unemployable. Except maybe by the rat who turned me in.
Look, Polak, I'm good at my job.
I'll make it worth your while. You take care of the details, I do the hit. No risk. We split 50-50.
Trying to be my partner?
It's short term. Roy's got to think I'm retired.
You're Polish, I'm Dutch-Irish. We're not exactly membership material. Might as well look out for each other, right?
Let me ask you this. I'm a 41-year-old woman. Most women in their early 40s have all secretly had an obsession with Winona Ryder. I'm just sharing that with the group. I don't know why she just did this.
I don't think that's gender-specific, Claudia.
Oh, right, I'm happy about it.
That runs across all areas.
How is she in it?
She's very good in this. It's obviously the less showy role. She plays the demure, incurious little wife back in the suburbs raising a family who's not really quite sure what her husband does and maybe doesn't ask too many questions. She's a fascinating actor, and she always has been, right?
Yes.
Back in her heyday in the kind of early 90s. And then obviously she's had sort of various troubles, and those troubles are kind of... This film uses that. This film uses that slightly brittle, fragile quality that she has to very good effect. And of course... Just by being this elfin little woman, she stands in great contrast to the Hulk who comes home from work every day and dotes on her. He is a doting family man. And it's that classic thing of separation of work and home.
Of course. And sometimes you end up rooting for these people. You know, you go, oh, I want it all to turn out well for him. And then you have
kind
to remind
of do,
yourself.
And yet he's not going for sympathy here. This isn't a sympathetic portrait. It's a portrait of basically the banality of evil. He is implacable. He's utterly ruthless. And perhaps if there's a slight flaw with this film, it feels a little bit overfamiliar in its 1970s setting of, you know, it's got the glitter balls, it's got the roller rinks, it's got the big sideburns, it's got Ray Liotta, who obviously stirs memories of sort of Goodfellas, and it's not as good as Goodfellas.
Nothing
but
is.
But it's a very, very efficient, gripping mafia thriller.
OK, brilliant. I'm definitely seeing that. The Iceman is Certificate 15. It's in cinemas now. Let's talk about Thérèse
Descoureaux is a film, it's a posthumous film, actually, from the great French filmmaker Claude Miller, who was a protégé of François Truffaut, made some great films like Une Secrète and Le Petit Voleurs, Betty Fisher and Other Stories. Was never quite seen as one of the greats, but was this very revered figure within French culture. Fittingly, perhaps, he died about this time last year, and this film was the closing film of last year's Cannes Film Festival. So it was like the French establishment kind of seeing him off with a great kind of fanfare, the equivalent of the 12-gun salute. He makes these very literate, exacting, often period films. In a way that you kind of think he's now gone, there's nobody else doing this. It was very much of a tradition of French cinema, and he was almost the last of the Mohicans. This is another one. It's based on a novel by François Mauriac from 1927. It stars Audrey Tautou as Thérèse, who's a sort of naive provincial girl who marries this boorish husband, Bernard, so that they can merge their two estates and create this kind of 11,000-acre empire. And then, of course, as is the way with such things, anyone who's read Madame Bovary knows these things kind of don't tend to work out well.
Yes. And then what happens? So, can you tell us anything?
Yeah, I can tell.
I'm having a look and I don't know what to give away.
There is a possible murder that one of the main major characters dies, and the finger of blame points towards the poor Thérèse, who is by this point pining for the high life in Paris and basically is wanting out. She's wanting emancipation. She's wanting a new life, and in that way she's a kind of modern woman. It's very nicely played by Audrey Tautou. It's very nicely played by Gilles Lelouch as Bernard. Possibly it's a little bit airless, possibly it's a little bit antiquated, and it does feel like a film from another time. It's set in the 1920s, but it feels like it's a film that's about kind of 20, 30 years out of date. But I think there's still an audience for this kind of solid, well-upholstered, good-looking human drama, and Thérèse Descoureaux does that perfectly well.
OK, good. This is a good week for films.
It's a very good week for films.
There's a lot. Thérèse is Certificate 12A. It's in cinemas now. If you don't want to go to the cinema and you have a house full of offspring, your DVD choice is...
DVD choice this week is Wreck-It Ralph, which is... a Disney cartoon. I read actually it's the 52nd Disney cartoon, which I wasn't aware of.
Wow.
It's perhaps not up there with Pinocchio, but it's certainly in the middle rank of Disney cartoons. And the middle rank of Disney cartoons is pretty
it's
high
a rich,
standard.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good standard. This is voiced by John C. Reilly as Ralph, who is this bruiser, digital bruiser in an arcade game called Fix It Felix. And he's sick of being the bruiser, he's sick of being the villain, he wants to break out. And it's a film that jumps very merrily across all different kinds of video games, from the antiquated old Pac-Man film games through to big first-person shoot-em-ups, with a great performance from Jane Lynch as Sergeant Calhoun, and another great performance actually from Sarah Silverman as Vanellope, who lives in this game called Sugar Rush, which is this horrible tweeny nightmare of kind of bright, lurid colours and squeaking little munchkins. It's one of those films that perhaps is a little bit too hyperactive, but it honours its world. And if a mark of a good film is that it takes you into an outlandish place and makes you completely believe that it all fits together, this film does that. And I actually thoroughly enjoyed it. And I went in very much a sceptic and came out converted.
I quite liked it. My children loved it so as often as the way that they were like, again,
maybe
again.
They have better taste than
they
us.
They definitely have better taste. Did you see Epic?
No, I didn't see Epic.
I tried to bribe them halfway through to leave.
To leave and they wouldn't.
Didn't work.
No.
Mummy, the only thing I want to do is go back to Epic. I'm like, fair enough. What
Sometimes
do I know?
They know best.
They definitely know best. I just think, before we finish, have you seen World War Z?
I haven't seen World War Z. I'm hearing mixed things.
That's all I'm asking. OK. Wreck-It Ralph is out on DVD on Monday. For details of everything Zan's reviewed, please visit the Radio 2 Art Show page, bbc.co.uk/Radio 2. ABBA, Voulez-Vous. I couldn't help but just sort of shout it then, because me and my next guest are pretty excited about that. Before he hit the bestseller charts as one of Britain's leading crime writers, Mark Billingham was variously a stand-up comic, an actor and a scriptwriter, combining all three on Tony Robinson's much-loved children's show, Made Marian and Merry Men. Mark's career took a sharp detour when he dreamt up his first novel, Sleepyhead, while on holiday in 1999. His new novel, The Dying Hours, is the latest in the D.I. Tom Thorne series. I'm delighted to welcome Mark Billingham to the Radio 2 Art Show. Thanks so much for coming in.
That's OK.
Is that true, that you were on holiday and thought... Because I like the idea that you were like, hold on, love, I'm going to the buffet. I've had an idea.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. I'd read this book called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Yes, of course.
You know, this guy had this horrendous thing, locked-in syndrome, and had dictated the entire book by blinking. And I just thought, this is what a horrendous thing. And then this little twisted part of me went, I wonder if you could do that to somebody on purpose.
Yes.
And my wife at the time, who's my wife, not my wife at the time, she's still my wife, but at the time she was directing... She was directing Casualty. And she said, come and talk to the kind of medical guy on Casualty, who was this brilliant guy. And I spoke to him. I said, could you do it to somebody on purpose? And he went, that is so twisted. You know, with a glint in his eye.
Yeah.
And he said, you could, but if you got it ever so slightly wrong, you'd kill them. And I knew there was a crime novel right there. So, yeah.
Wow. And how quickly, because it feels like when I read your books, I feel like it's coming out fast. I mean that in a good way.
Yeah.
It's not, nothing's laboured.
Yeah. Pace is kind of everything, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I you know, when I'm reading, and I'm a reader first and foremost, I mean, I think every writer is, if I'm suddenly, you know, if my mind is wandering, if I run into a kind of narrative brick wall, if I want to do something else, I'm going to put that book down and pick up another one. You know, life's too short. So even though you kind of obviously work really hard at making it feel kind of pacey and immediate, it's got to be pacey and immediate. I've got to kind of drag you through the narrative, kicking and screaming, you know.
Tell us about the new book. Tell us about Thorne, who's back in uniform.
Yes, he's back in uniform. Well, the weird thing was, this is thanks to a couple of uniformed coppers who got in touch with me a couple of years ago, these two amazing women who were fans of the books, and they said, OK, you know, you're always writing about CID and detectives. Come and see what it's like at the sharp end. So I went out with them on a couple of overnight shifts, bank holiday Friday in Croydon.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it was, you know, it started with a body, it ended with a body. Oh, it was real, real baptism of fire stuff. And they were amazing, these women. I was just so... I'm in the back of the car trying to sort of make notes in a Met vest. And any time anything kicked off, they'd just go, study the car!
I mean, you were like, what, somebody shoplifted?
Yeah, but... well, no. I mean, the worst thing is when you're on Blues and Twos, when you're doing kind of 85 miles an hour on a suburban street at 3 a.m, I mean, it's just kind of terrifying. So anyway, in the middle of this overnight shift in a Chinese restaurant at 2 a.m, Chinese takeaway, they said, why don't you put Thorne back into uniform? And I said, how'd you do that? And they said, well, if a detective inspector messes up badly enough, he can get bumped back down
demoted.
To just...
Demoted.
Well, he's
Not
still
demoted.
An inspector... But he's he's back in uniform, and there is that real tension between uniform and non-uniform. And I knew that would work brilliantly, and Thorne had messed up in the book I just finished. So, yeah, that was it right there, thanks to those two coppers who were in the book. They are in this new book, very, very thinly disguised.
That's adorable that they got in touch with you. That sounds like that's slightly stalkery.
Well, no,
they
were
outside your house.
Hello, we like your books.
Yeah,
we
come
know
on,
where
a
you
night
live.
Shift.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never go home again. No, they, I mean, so coppers do get in touch. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, thankfully, they're saying, you know, we hate it when people get stuff wrong. And you know, most of the time you get it right and we enjoy the book. Every so often I will get something wrong and a copper will tell me. And I go, thanks very much. You're now on my list of contacts and I will be asking you questions.
Do you often get in touch, other than these women? Do you often just go, can you just talk me through the hours or whatever it is? Or
sometimes, but it's less about that kind of minutiae. And actually, it's more about just the banter, the stories they tell you. And honestly, some of the stories I've heard, if I put them in the book, you'd go, that's ridiculous.
No.
That's always the stuff that you just would never believe. I mean, can I tell you one?
Yes.
It's a bit horrific. It's
Friday night.
Well, you know that thing when a copper has to deliver the death message? I wrote a book called Death Message about that horrendous moment when a police officer has to tell somebody that a loved one has died. I mean, just horrendous. And I was talking to these coppers about it, and they were talking me through it, and they said, well, there was this one incident when a guy in the centre of London was found impaled on a... not like he'd fallen from a height, just lying across this metal pole through his kind of neck. Horrible, horrible, horrible. Anyway, they'd got no idea who he was. Yeah. So they looked, he was wearing a rucksack, so they dig around his rucksack, they find a name and address, they go and they ring the doorbell and they tell his wife, and his wife is in pieces. You know, she's absolutely in bits, of course, and they're talking her through counselling and they're making a tea and they're pouring her whiskey and whatever. Half an hour later, key in the lock, in walks her husband.
Huh?
And she, well, absolutely, that's the reaction. And she goes, oh my God, where have you been? He goes, what, you won't believe the day I've had, somebody stole my rucksack.
No!
And yeah, if I put that in a book, a guy nicks his rucksack, runs away, car hits him, impaled on some rail. I mean, you can't make that stuff up.
I can't believe it!
I know.
I want that because also, when your world is over and then suddenly it's not over.
I know, can you imagine emotional roller coaster? I know. So it's getting those kind of stories and just the way cops are with each other.
Yes.
You know, it is a weird world. They've all got nicknames. They play tricks on each other all the time. If I tell you that those cops know I'm coming on the show, right, and they gave me a word that I had to try and get into the interview with you, because that's what they do.
Yes.
When they say, you know, sometimes we're doing serious interview and somebody will say, oh, you've got to get the word penguin in. You know, they'll do that. They will do.
Yeah.
I haven't managed to get the word in yet, by the way.
Oh, but you so will. when I do rubbish telly, somebody will always give me a word. I'll tell you
the
one I can't do. I can never get it in. Corfu. I mean, I just have. But it's taken me 20 years.
That doesn't
years.
Count, right? If it doesn't count, if you're kind
count,
of telling me.
It doesn't count, because I had to say, can you imagine, were you on holiday in Corfu? How much fun do you have coming up with a baddie? Is that where you have to begin? And now let's talk about what happens in this book a bit.
Our baddie. I mean, you know, lots of writers, crime writers especially, will be all sort of disingenuous and go, well, no, I like to inhabit all the characters and I'm as much that character. It is great fun when you come up with a good baddie. You know, the devil has all the best tunes. And when you do come up with a cracking baddie, it is just brilliant. You can kind of take the rest of the day off. You kind of go, he's great, I like him.
But how do you embody it? Because you are, well, I hope, because you're sitting opposite me in quite a dark studio, but you are a very nice individual. How do you get into the mindset of a killer?
I genuinely believe that writing a book is a performance. I'm from a performance background. Yeah. You know, you said I was an actor and I was a stand-up. And it's like an acting job. You're getting in the heads of different characters. You know, what do they look like? What are they wearing? What are their shoes like? How do they walk? How do they speak? It is just kind of an acting job, and I'm trying to give the best performance I can and entertain the reader in the best possible way. So, yeah, I'm acting, and sometimes I'm acting a horrible character.
Tell us about The Dying Hours and what happens.
Well, Thorne is in uniform and he hates it. He hates the fact that he's not a detective inspector anymore. He's just an inspector. And he comes across this cluster of suicides among the elderly. And he thinks there's something very sinister going on. And he goes to the murder squad. He does the right thing. He goes to the murder squad he used to be part of. And they just dismiss him. And they say, stop playing detective. And it just kills him. Kills him. But you know, of course, it being a Thorne novel, he's right, but he has to kind of investigate it on his own with the help of a few old friends from his old squad. And we discover reasonably early on who's doing what they're doing, who's doing what, you know, it's a sort of Columbo type thing. I'm a big fan of Columbo.
Yeah. Who isn't?
And I don't think there's any problem with knowing who your killer is, but we don't quite know exactly who he is, and we don't know why he's doing what he's doing. So him and Thorne are on this kind of collision course.
Can I ask you this, if you don't mind? Val McDermott said that she was talking about crime writers, female crime writers and male, and she said that women write about what violence feels like and men write about what violence looks like, if you like, and you are the only man who does the former and you do it sensitively. And I don't know whether you knew that. Is that because you had a horrible experience, or do you try not to make it... I don't mean graphic, but you...
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
From the inside out, rather than...
Yes, I mean, I think... Well, I do take what Val says as a massive compliment, especially coming from her. And I think, genuinely speaking, she's right. You know, she talks about how women kind of grow up, you know, in fear. They know what it's like to be afraid because they're kind of taught it from an early age. Don't go down that dark alley. Don't, you know, watch what you're doing, all that kind of stuff. In a way that men aren't. That's completely true. And yes, I had a horrible experience. I was attacked in a hotel room, of all things, by three guys who burst in and held me hostage for a couple of hours and stuff. And it was not nice. I mean, I was fine, as violent attacks go. It was, you know, but it was the fear.
That must have been so terrifying.
I had no idea what they were going to do, and they held me in there for about 3 hours because they needed to use my cash point card either side of midnight. So they just let the time go, and I had no idea if they were going to kill me, if I was going to see my wife and kids again, all that. Horrible, absolutely. But, so from that point on, I always wanted to write about victims, and I kind of know what it's like to be afraid. Yeah. I think I'm quite good at writing about that. Not like being on a roller coaster afraid or watching a scary movie afraid.
Thinking your life might be over.
But literally, I can remember, my heart was thumping so hard, I was bouncing off the carpet. I can just remember leaving the carpet. And yeah, I think early on, a lot of writers make their books too graphic. They throw the kitchen sink at it. And actually, I've really come to the conclusion that, you know, a single spot of blood on a pristine kitchen floor is a much more powerful image than blood splattered up the walls. Less is more, definitely.
You're totally right, because the imagination fills
That's
in the
That's what reading is. The reader's imagination is far more, you know, skilled at conjuring images up than anything a writer can do.
May I ask you this? Lots of our listeners are writers themselves, or they want to write, and I always ask this, because it's always fascinating, about how and when you do it. Whether, you know, lots of people say to me, look, I've just got to get 5,000 words done a day, and I have to have my phone off. Or other people say, do you know what, I write longhand and I write when I want to. How do you do it?
I certainly don't write 5,000 words. I'd kill to write 5,000 words a day. I don't write every day.
Do you not?
I know you kind of should, but the writing, the actual sitting at a computer and getting it down on a screen or on paper, that's just the kind of technical side of it. The book is happening when you're pushing a trolley around the supermarket, or when you're walking the dogs, or picking the kids up from school. I mean, it's in your head all the time, and you're working stuff out. I'm very disciplined about it. I write a book every year, but that's because I'm, you know, lucky enough to write full time. I've got no excuse not to write a book every year. And I read a lot. You know, the number of people that want to write books, and I say to them, who do you read? And they say, oh, I don't read.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? It's like, you think you could be a chef without eating food. I mean, that's just ludicrous. You've got to read really widely and, you know, take from the best and look at the people that are writing stuff that, you know, that are raising the bar. You know, we were talking before about, you know, people like Elmore Leonard. You know, it's one of the greatest writers on the planet, let alone a crime writer. You look at writers like that and go, that's what I'm aiming for. You know?
Do you feel a great sense of accomplishment when you've done one? Do you? I mean, that just must be...
It's the best feeling.
Yeah, after the editing and the writing and the creation and all of these things, just to go, boom, that's it, send it off.
Yeah, somebody once said to Dorothy Parker, do you enjoy writing? And she said, I enjoy having written. And I just get that. I know exactly what she means. When it's done, it's just like, hurrah. Because I love this bit, actually. Yeah. You know, I'm such a show-off. I kind of like talking to people and doing events on stage and doing all that performing thing again. But unfortunately, it doesn't last very long because that's done and then there's a little voice in your head going, got to start the next one.
Yes.
And then that blank screen looking at you.
Do you already know the next one?
The next one's kind of three quarters done. You're working a kind of a year ahead, at least a year ahead. So yeah, the next one's three quarters done. Another Thorne, nasty, twisty Thorne adventure with the nastiest guy he's ever put away, who's been in a couple of earlier books, who is back.
And my goodness.
He's somebody who I enjoy writing about. It's bad.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for
coming
in. And enormous luck with it.
Thank you.
Not that you need it. The Dying Hours by Mark Billingham is published by Little Brown. It's out now. Still to come on tonight's show, book critic Alex Hemmingsley. And in just a moment, we head to the opera at Glyndebourne with Andy West and Radio 2 Art Show listener Nancy for a peek behind the scenes of their summer season. That's right after this. You're listening to the Radio 2 Art Show with me, Claudia Winkleman. Glyndebourne 2013 has begun. The annual festival is a rich and diverse celebration of the very best opera in the world. Around 150,000 people converge on the Country House in East Sussex every year to watch an array of lavish performances. But Glyndebourne isn't just for the opera buffs. It wants to persuade new audiences that opera is something to rejoice in. Not easy when a lot of people see the art form as highbrow, elitist, impossible to understand, and I say this cautiously, boring. The Radio 2 Art Show's Andy West took one of our listeners to Glyndebourne to see what she made of it.
So we're driving through the countryside. We've just taken a turning into the left, and this is Glyndebourne.
Oh, I'm really excited.
The sky is just clear blue, isn't it? We're surrounded by trees already. We're only in the car park. So we can already see people dressed up pretty smartly here. Talk us through your outfit, actually, because part of Glyndebourne is what people wear, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I'm wearing navy shoes.
By?
I think the Marks and Spencers, actually. A navy dress. Now, I like this dress because it hides everything underneath it.
Well, I'm very proud to have you on my arm.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, and you.
So you've been here a couple of times before.
Yes, been here a couple of times. Not that would admit it to many people, because I have actually sat through some performances where I've just not understood a single thing. The trouble is, it's quite often a story within a story. It's quite often in another language. And everyone talks like that. There was the Hansel and Gretel one I've got to tell you about that. I thought, right, Nancy, come on. You're going to sit here and really pay attention. Really try. Really try. Don't look at handbags. Don't look at hairstyle. Don't look at dresses. Just really sit there and pay attention. And after about 15 minutes, I was thinking about my shopping list for the next day. So it doesn't grasp me.
So we're standing in the gardens now. It's just starting to fill up. We've got our champagne. We're doing a bit of people watching, and Glyndebourne, we've discovered, is amazing for people watching.
Yeah, we've seen the 70s couple, haven't we? We've seen the pop star with the hair that's too long.
Not like a purple and green velvet jacket. Hey, look at that over there. Look at her. Her dress is just sparkling in the sunshine. It's covered in sequins all over.
The lake's beautiful. It's like a painting, isn't it? It's like a Monet painting.
I tell you what, we've spotted some people over here. Let's go and have a chat to them and see if they're enjoying their afternoon so far. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
So, what are you up to?
I'm just opening up some more champagne.
Wow.
Sweet.
Oh. We have here the remnants of, what's that, profiteroles?
It was some eclairs, yeah. They were delicious.
So is this your first time at Glyndebourne?
It is, yes. I've never seen opera before.
So you're not really supposed to ask a lady her age, but...
I'm 20.
Some people see opera as being something for older generations, that it's difficult to get younger people to come and watch it. Do you think it was a little bit tricky getting you here?
Actually, my parents booked tickets without me, and I forced them to buy me an extra one at last minute. You know, the old...
I'm David Pickard, and I'm the General Director of Glyndebourne.
Nancy and I were just enjoying a bit of champagne in the grounds. Thanks, I think what we should do, if we just stand and face the house first, all three of us.
Sure.
And just take a look at what we can see. It's a classic English stately home, isn't it?
It is. It's an Elizabethan home built in the 15th century. But it's got this rather extraordinary addition to it on the right-hand side as we look here, which is the organ room. It's the room where John Crissey, well, first of all, as the name suggests, he put an organ in there. And the organ room is really where Glyndebourne started. What happened later on in the organ room was there were little informal concert performances of opera, which John organised with his friends. And the very significant thing was in the 1930s, when in one of these opera performances in the organ room, a young singer called Audrey Mildmay came and sang a role, and John was smitten with her instantly. They married within a year. And it was she who said to John, look, if you're going to do this opera thing, for goodness sake, do it properly. And that's kind of been our slogan ever since.
If we now turn around 180 degrees, we see a completely different aspect. All of a sudden we're on the edge of rolling hills with sheep and woodland in the distance. And
it's an absolutely stunning view over the South Downs, and there's no other opera house in the world.
No, there's not.
Where you get to the end when you see an animal in a field, you know.
But lacking. It's part of the charm.
It is.
It's part of the charm.
It's part of the eccentricity as well. It's a slightly mad place.
Yeah. It's lovely to meet you.
And you too, Nancy.
And
yeah, enjoy tonight.
Thank you.
All the best.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. Andy, do you mind if we just go and look at the flowers?
No, we can do that. Just up here. The gardens here are lovely, aren't they? If you, I mean, this is part of the joy of this place for you, Nancy, isn't it? Coming here and looking at the flowers and the plants.
I know. I just look at the splendour of them. Everything's statuesque, all these plants sticking their heads up and amongst all the sunshine. It's lovely.
All right, then. We're going to go and talk now to Kate Lindsay, who's the star of tonight's performance. And it looks like she's just over there.
I'm Kate Lindsay. I'm here singing the role of the composer in Ariadne of Naxos.
Kate, are you inspired by your surroundings here?
It helps immensely, actually, because from our dressing rooms, we have a beautiful view over the fields, and I'll open the window and have the breeze rolling in, hearing the sheep and the lambs sort of doing their little out there. And it's really relaxing.
I'm interested to know if you are a city girl or are you a country girl?
I'm a suburb girl, I would say. Yeah. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. And I've sort of lost a little bit of the southern accent. Most of my family is southern United States. Everybody talks southern like best. That. But I lost that when I went to college because all of my friends made fun of me for saying, hey, y'all.
A lot of people are really not confident about the feeling of opera, young people especially.
When opera was being composed, it was being composed for everyone to enjoy, and that's still the point of it now.
I, for years, didn't go and see opera because people said, it will look stunning, but you won't understand a word of it. And a lot of people are really scared about that. Tonight's performance, will we actually understand what's going on?
Gosh, I hope so.
What language are you singing in?
Singing in German.
Right.
We're singing in German this evening. Having the subtitles there are valuable. Even if I'm going and listening to something in English, it's still hard to get. And the story becomes very clear. You can grasp it without completely understanding. I say that about love, too. Like, you can love someone without completely understanding them.
By the way, Kate, I think Nancy lives just down the road from you, where you're staying, in Ditchling.
Ditchling! Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm staying. I'm staying right down the street.
Where are you staying?
I'm in Westmeston.
Are you? Good. It's lovely then. You must walk up to the
up
top
to
of the downs.
Oh, I've been
you
up to the downs, especially for the sunset, up to Ditchling Beacon.
Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it?
So I think I'd better get back to the dressing room. It's warm-up time, and I've got fitted for my mic tonight. We're doing a live streaming here, which you can see on the internet.
Oh, she's charming. Isn't she charming? I can't wait to hear her sing now. And beautiful teeth. Didn't she have lovely teeth?
Hey, I think that's the bell. I think that's us. Ticket. Where are our tickets? Oh, they're here.
I found it wonderful. I do appreciate it. It's just a little bit dramatic for me.
But maybe the great thing about Glyndebourne is, you know, if you're not so keen on the operatic style, at least you can come here and enjoy the surroundings and come here with someone who's a big fan of the opera and you're both happy.
Absolutely. I mean, you've got both. You've got everything. You've got the gardens, the picnic. You've got everything, really. It's been just wonderful. Super. Thank you very much. It's been great. I might even get a feel for it, you know.
Well, cheers to that.
Cheers.
Oh, the Glyndebourne Festival runs until August the 25th. Alex Hemmingsey joins me with her latest selection of books after Smokey Robinson. That was Smokey Robinson with Cruising, and you can see Smokey Robinson in the lineup for Radio 2's Live in Hyde Park on Sunday, the 8th of September. I suggest we go together, Alex Hemmingsey.
Yeah,
why wouldn't we?
Well, he's to the ready.
Come on! Book critic, as I said, Alex Hemmingsey is here. You've got four books that are female.
Yes, well, it's so many name changes. This week was the Women's Prize, which is now the Bailey's Women's Prize, having been the Orange Prize. It's all the same prize, same board, all of that. But there's been this week's switch. So I thought I'd cast forward to the coming year of female fiction to look out for some stuff that's been out a little, like a week or two, and some stuff that's coming up.
So. OK, you're very clever. First one, Sisterland. Sisterland, Curtis Sittenfield is one of my favourite authors. She wrote An American Wife and Prep. She's American, and this is set in the States, and it's just completely beautiful. It looks like it's going to be one thing, but it's actually something completely different. So I don't want you to make funny faces when I explain the basic premise.
Oh, here we go.
It's twin sisters who... we're in America, we're sort of Southern America. Twin sisters who, as young girls, realise that they both have psychic ability, kind of premonitions. So there's a sort of supernatural element, but it isn't a science fiction book about magic, or it isn't that at all.
And they have some sort of telepathy, if you like, with each other.
No,
with the world.
Sort of future world events. So this manifests itself in that you sort of see them grow up, sort of adulthood, they have their own children. And one of them just wants an easy life, wants nothing to do with it, is in denial. And the other one thinks, I can see a way. I can get something out of this. And when there's a small earthquake in their town, the other one then becomes like a seer and says there's going to be a much bigger one, which obviously brings a huge media circus. All of which sounds like, that's a bit wacky for me, a bit sort of supernatural weirdness. What this book really is a book about sibling rivalry and family dynamics and having your own family and how you all fit in, and that constant sort of Tetris bricks of fitting in all the siblings that goes on in all families. And Curtis Sittenfield, I mean, there are some books that you read for the plot and for the atmosphere or whatever, but Curtis Sittenfield is one of those writers that does that thing when you're reading and you think, oh, I thought it was just me that had thought that.
Yes.
Thank goodness I'm not the only one that's gone through that rage about something so insignificant, or noticed the way that sometimes people do that.
Yes.
That kind of real golden sweet spot of reading when you realise that you're not quite as alone in the world as you thought you might be.
This
just about little
excellent.
Kind of 3 o'clock in the morning thoughts that people have.
Okay. Brilliant. Sisterland by Curtis Sittenfield is published by Transworld. It's out this week. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the next one.
Yonalossi.
Thank you. Riding Camp for Girls.
The Yonalossi Riding Camp for Girls is also just lush, lovely, like a gorgeous, charming read. It is set in a sort of late, very late 1920s, early 1930s, sort of Southern America.
We should say the author. It's Anton Discalfani.
Discalfini, I think. Okay. Discalfani, yeah. And our sort of heroine is Thea, who's a young girl, sort of young teenager, who is sent away from... She's from a very well-to-do, wealthy family in the States, who's sent away to the Yonalossi Riding Camp for Girls on account of a great scandal that she's caused the family, which in itself, obviously, completely I'm reeled in. But then we get this really beautiful coming-of-age novel. There's all that sort of lovely stuff about moneyed Americans, where you get class and fitting in and teenage angst, but with the sort of rumbling of the depression coming. It's very, very atmospheric, but really good on that teen angst stuff, so it's beautiful.
Okay. Yonalossi, Riding Camp for Girls by Anton Discalfani. I hope I haven't offended too many people there. It's published by Headline. It's out now. Let's talk about The Other Typist by Suzanne Rindell.
I absolutely adored this book. I thought that I might have been just loving it because I was reading on the plane to New York, but then I deliberately stopped and saved the rest for when I was back, just in case, but it turns out it works just as well in the UK. It is set in New York, Prohibition era New York, 1920s, in a police station in the skankiest bit of the Lower East Side. So it's really rough bathtub gin dealer types coming in the sort of secretary pool. So already it's like a really fun, gossipy, rattly environment. And there's a sort of nerdy secretary, a real proper blue stocking, who likes everything to be just so. She's the real computer says no type. And then swans in is this new Odalie, this new secretary who's unfeasibly glamorous, seems to know everything and seems to have secrets on everyone, and a sort of single white female almost friendship bubbles along, and it's sort of set partly in the police station itself, but then they become buddies, so it's speakeasies and glamorous parties, and they end up living together, and there's this
Can
whole...
I just say right now I don't like the glamorous one?
Well, there's this sort of string of anxiety that pulls tighter and tighter, because obviously the rest of us reading won't like her, but you don't know if to trust her or not. There's part of you going, well,
maybe she's just got really great hair.
Yeah, and is
maybe
actually
I'm
lovely.
A really judgmental person. And you don't know. You don't know which way it's going to go. Who's telling the truth? The whole thing kind of really, almost like a Hall of Mirrors environment that ends up sort of rattling along in the inside of your brain. And it is hugely, really fun, really tight. It's beautifully, beautifully written. It's not like a kind of purely commercial page turner, but it really is a page turner too. I was absolutely gripped. I loved it. I loved all the grubby detail.
Okay, this sounds good. The Other Typist by Suzanne Rindell. It's published by Fig Tree. It's out now. Let's talk about the next one, The Art of Being a Woman.
This isn't strictly, well, it isn't fiction, but it's a sort of absolutely gorgeous memoir that part biography, part autobiography, strangely. Patricia Volk is writing about her mother, who was 1950s dreamboat housewife, a real Betty Draper. Gorgeous looking, but also not just beautiful, but the real not a hair out of place version of beautiful.
Immaculate.
Immaculate, but knew all the rules and knew how to play by them. And then Patricia discovers a copy of Shocking Life, which is the biography of Elsa Schiaparelli, the hugely kind of flamboyant fashion director who worked in the sort of 40s, 50s, 60s, the character in Funny Face, that Audrey yes. Hepburn film is based on, who there was no rule that was there not to be broken. There was nothing that could not be said. There was nothing too flamboyant, no colour too pink. And it just rocks her world. So what the way that the book is written is sort of a combination of both of these women's lives. And the title is The Art of Being a Woman. And it's this sort of realisation in a young woman that there isn't just one way to be a woman, yeah. that you can be polar opposites, you can be somewhere in the middle, and there's an awful lot of thinking and accessorizing and politics, but also fantastic sofas and shoes, and the kind of wonderful kind of multi-layered look at what it would be being a woman and yeah. in the sort of second half of the 20th century and then looking forwards. But it's also really kind of sweet memoir about growing up and about when you what being a mother is, and all, but it, and it's also hugely illustrated. It has gorgeous photographs about of both of the women in it, and it has a really, as you can see,
this sounds excellent.
It's really lovely. It's quite unusual. Like, I sort of wouldn't really know where to put it, but it really grabs you. It's sort of just sort of charming.
You have, as usual, brought four brilliant books in. If you were going to choose one, because we can't all buy four, what would you? I think Sisterland.
I think Sisterland too. Sisterland's the one that will echo the longest in your mind.
As usual, you brought four brilliant books in. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Art of Being a Woman by Patricia Volk is published by Hutchinson. It's out now. For all the details of everything Alex has talked about, please visit the Radio 2 Art Show page, bbc.co.uk/Radio 2. In just a moment, Andy West gives us a taster of what's happening in the world of the arts around the whole country for the next week. That's after this. Time now for the Arts Roundup with Andy West, here to tell us what's happening in the world of the arts around the country for the next 7 days. Talk to us.
Thank you, Claudia. Well, we'll start in Glasgow for tomorrow night only. Entertainment, comedy, magic and burlesque. Featuring performances from the like of burlesque acts Nona Nightmare and Cyclone Jack, neither of whom I've heard of, but both sound fantastic, and comedians Gary Little and Michael Redmond. It's in Hold underneath the Admiral Bar, Glasgow. Starts at 8, tickets £10. Cardiff, tomorrow night you can see the Anglo-Welsh Festival of Male Choirs at the Hayes Theatre. Don't miss this opportunity to experience the majesty of a massed male choir as the voices of Biddulph, Bridgend, Cardiff Arms Park and many more male choirs combine with an orchestra for a magical evening of music. In Ilford, tomorrow sees the opening of the internationally renowned Ilford Arts Festival, which includes opera, picnic proms and cloister concerts. It runs until August, and La Traviata is on until the 22nd. In Norwich, and the Fusion Digital Gallery is showcasing photographs which reflect the impact immigration has had on the city. It starts on Monday and runs until next weekend. To Northampton, where they brew Carlsberg. Did you know that?
No.
Well, it's nothing to do with what I'm about to tell you, but
nice.
They did.
Love a fact.
The American guitar legend Woody Mann is at the Thunk Shop Cafe to screen his film about the Reverend Gary Davis, who was a ragtime and gospel musician. I've Googled both, and frankly, I became addicted and enriched. And that's this Tuesday, but buy your tickets now. And to the Williams Art Gallery in Cambridge. Do you sometimes go to Cambridge and think, what lovely trees? I do, and that's why this one caught my attention. For 25 years, John Preston and Neil Walmsley have both been inspired by Cambridge's rich heritage of trees. John, being a talented artist, has created some new etchings, including snowy landscapes featuring trees from Cambridge and beyond. And that exhibition has just opened and will run until the 17th of June.
Thank you so much. I love a beautiful tree. It's divine.
Oh, you could just stand and look at it for days.
Can I just have a conversation with you about Heyon Wye?
You may.
A lot of very different, very beautiful trees. Just saying. If you like trees, have a look. For all the details of everything Andy has talked about, please go to the Radio 2 Art Show page, bbc.co.uk/radio2. I hope you've enjoyed this free download from the BBC. Don't forget, the Radio 2 Art Show is on every Friday at 10 p.m, and our latest programme is on the BBC iPlayer. You can find out more about the Radio 2 Art Show by visiting bbc.co.uk/radio2.